Hi, I'm Hillary Acer, welcoming you to Raise the Line with Osmosis from Elsevier, an ongoing exploration about how to improve health and healthcare. As we've discussed with other guests who've joined us on the podcast as part of our core focus on rare diseases, one major problem in the space is finding enough patients with any particular rare condition to conduct clinical trials. Our guest today, Dr. Lucas Lang, co-founded a company called Probably Genetic, which is seeking to address that problem through free, direct-to-consumer genetic testing, and we're looking forward to finding out how it all works. Before launching Probably Genetic in 2019, Dr. Lang was a biotech advisor for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He also holds a PhD in bioinformatics and genetics from the University of Oxford. Thank you so much, Dr. Lang, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge Osmosis fan and have read many of the articles you've put out, so I'm excited to be here.
We're really happy to hear that, and we'll probably touch a little bit more on Year of the Zebra in just a moment, or rare disease education, but let's start by hearing more about what first got you interested in science overall.
I think that, honestly, the very first thing that got me excited about scientific progress was the development of hydrogen-powered cars in high school. Like, I remember I read an article when I was maybe, 13 or 14, thought it was fascinating. And then based on that, got more into it. And I thought the vision of having cars where you've just got water coming out of the exhaust was super exciting.
Wow, that is a very interesting kind of first inspiration. Somehow led you down the path of getting into the rare disease space and genetic space. So how did you make the jump from cars to genetics?
Yeah, based on that hydrogen motivation, studied chemical engineering. I did that in Munich and got an undergraduate degree, and ended up working not on hydrogen powered cars, but on electric car batteries, which at the time felt like a nascent, very juvenile field. And now is obviously how the car industry is run. And then I went to the University of Cambridge for my master's degree and ended up in a group that also focused on electrochemistry, but they focused on biodiagnostic devices as an application. So building blood glucose sensors. And that's really my first foray into healthcare. And then decided I want to learn more about healthcare, specifically, like broadly, but specifically genetics, because I just got excited about genetics as a field. And then won a Rhodes Scholarship and went to Oxford. And I had funding to fund a PhD with that scholarship, and wanted to study genetics, and serendipitously landed in a rare genetic disease group that just so happened to not only work on rare diseases as a priority, but one of my PhD supervisors actually set up the 100,000 Genomes Project in the UK and raised all the money from the British government to pull off that amazing project. And that's sort of how I got thrust into it. And then got exposed to all the challenges rare disease families have to deal with. And that's kind of how it all started.
Wow. We've covered rare diseases at length across the podcast, but I don't think we've touched as much on this project in the UK. Can you tell us a little bit more about the 100,000 Genome Project?
Yeah, it's a fascinating study. To my knowledge, it's still the largest rare disease study on the planet. The original motivation, I would say, was really twofold. The first one was to sequence 100,000 genomes of people who predominantly had rare diseases, mostly non-cancer, but also a lot of cancer patients, to one, figure out if we could deliver diagnoses for them, and two, understand if whole genome sequencing as a technology should really be the next wave of how we do diagnostics in rare diseases, which at the time and sort of still today was an open question. And I think from my perspective as a scientist, it makes perfect sense, but I understand there's cost considerations around that too. So that was one part. And I think the other part that the UK really got right that I think other countries still struggle with is that not only can you do tremendous things for our patients and for healthcare doing that, but you can also build up this phenomenally valuable resource for a country like the UK, where if you think of healthcare data as a resource similar to oil or coal or whatever else you have as an export, then you can really do fantastic things with that and build a whole new industry. And I think they accomplished both things with that.
Fascinating. And that somehow led you down the path of founding a company, Probably Genetic. So tell us about that mission and what you're up to lately.
Yeah. So when I was doing my PhD, I mostly worked on bioinformatics, meaning patients would already spend their 7 to 8 years on average being undiagnosed. And then miraculously, they would get lucky enough to see a physician who somehow knew about the 100,000 Genomes Project and who would take a DNA sample from them. And then that would go to our lab. And once we had the sample at the lab, that would get sequenced. And then once we had the raw genetic data, somebody like me would start working on that data to try to figure out why is this patient sick when somebody else is healthy? And we'd analyze their DNA, we'd try to figure it out. And for a good chunk of my PhD, I was really just focused on that numbers side of the problem, like the technology to analyze DNA. But once you realize that all the patients we see are the lucky ones, and being lucky already means, 7+ years of not knowing what the hell's going on with them, that really makes you question how the entire system works. Especially since this is not a genetic diagnostic problem, right? Like, we have the technology to get these patients tested and figure out what's going on with a really good chunk of them. Not for all of them, but for a lot of the diseases, we know how the mechanisms work. And so the question that ensued for me was, well, what's going wrong in this system that we still have millions of people? We think about 200 million people globally who just never make it to the right test. And that's really where sort of the founding motivation for Probably Genetic was born, which is let's try to figure out how we can actually get that 200 million people who are undiagnosed diagnosed. So our mission became diagnose those 200 million people. And the question that we had to answer is, well, if that's what our mission is, how the hell do we pull it off? And the first place we started in was at the time pretty novel, but now feels really commonplace, which is, well, the symptomatic data on all of these patients lives in electronic health records. And if we can just figure out ways to analyze the symptomatic data and, tease out patterns and say, hey, I don't think this is just any kid. I think this is a Rett syndrome patient. And then say we need to get them tested, then we could find those patients. And so my co-founder and I started developing this algorithm in our spare time that tried to figure out if we plug in symptomatic data on patients that we get out of EHRs, can we get them diagnosed? And then we made the typical mistake that all techies do, which is we did not talk to patients, we did not talk to doctors, we did not talk to the hospital, and we just spent 6 months in our, magic time, as in like between midnight and 12 and on weekends developing this algorithm. And then we went to the hospital and told a PI there, hey, we've got this amazing algorithm. Can we get access to the EHR and show you how it works? And they said, amazing. Which one of our EHRs do you want to get access to? And then we started realizing just how difficult this problem is, because that particular hospital didn't have one EHR. They've got four, because cardiology's got one, neurology's got one, oncology's got one, and then there's a general one for the whole hospital. They're all different, and most of them don't have structured data in them. And so very quickly we realized, damn, the problem is not actually the algorithm, which is what we were excited about. It's everything else. And if you then think about the problem we're trying to solve is, which is we're trying to find the needle in the haystack patient. You cannot possibly scale that across the tens of thousands of hospitals on the planet. And then at the same time, I went to the American Society for Human Genetics meeting in San Diego in 2018 and met this mom of a young girl called Mila. And Mila later passed away from Batten disease, CLN2, but at the time she'd already been diagnosed. And I was telling her about this frustration we had with how we thought we could solve the problem but couldn't. And her name's Julia Vitarello. And Julia told me, I know exactly what you're talking about. Before Mila got diagnosed, I knew that she had an autism diagnosis. I knew that she had seizures. I knew that she could climb stairs previously and now she couldn't anymore. And I knew that she was losing her vision. And in my head, I thought, this mom knew the kid's phenotype long before the kid got diagnosed. Maybe the way to do this is just to give the parents tools to phenotype the kids, not perfectly, but just good enough. And if we can get the phenotypic data from the parents, we should then be able to identify patients who should get testing done. And so that's sort of where the journey began.
Incredible. I mean, I can hear how passionate you are about this, and I'm just grateful for people like you who haven't given up when they face difficult challenges, like a hospital with four different EHR systems. Clearly, this mother, Julia, has been a great inspiration, but also will probably benefit in the future. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about the tests themselves and how they actually work, detecting various genetic diseases, and maybe just the technology behind that.
Sure, I'll just explain the process pretty quickly. So I mentioned where the insight came from, right? The parents and often the patients, depending on the disease, they can describe their own symptoms. And so the idea was, what if the way to find these patients is not to integrate with healthcare records in hospitals? What if we just have to build technology that we can put on the web? And so we decided we're going to build phenotyping technology that we put on a website. And then the idea is, if you are a mom of a kid that's got all of these crazy symptoms and you're really worried about them and nobody's helping you, and you are in between running errands at Trader Joe's and dropping off your kid at an ABA clinic, and you've got that 3 minute, mental breakdown in your car, and then you've got 2 minutes of clarity right after that mental breakdown, and you're Googling your kid's symptoms. You should land on a website where you can provide very minimal information on your child. So, like some symptomatic descriptions, a facial photo, because often that's indicative of a specific disease, and some other information. And then we can run algorithms on that data in real time as you're on the website. And if the algorithms think that this person might have a specific genetic disease, then we have a whole telemedicine system built in the background where we process that information and we manage to get your test kit within about 48 hours of you being on the website. You don't pay anything for the whole thing. The test kit goes to you. You collect the sample. It's a, cheek swab or a saliva sample. And we're soon adding other biochemical tests as well. You return that sample to the lab. The lab runs the entire test, and you get a clinical lab report back. And the results are explained to you in a telemedicine genetic counseling session. And the whole thing's free for patients. We don't collect insurance information. We don't collect payment information. So that's how the process works for patients. And the idea is make it super simple. They don't have to pay. It's really fast. And the tests in the background are not actually our own tests. We partner with different clinical labs that can cover different types of tests. And we have a pretty large gamut already in the portfolio now. We can run all kinds of different panels. We can run very specialized genetic tests. We can run whole exomes and we can run whole genomes. And then we're working on non-genetic biochemical tests for other types of assays.
Wow, and it sounds like you all are just barely scratching the surface here. So I'm sure there's
Yes.
a lot more to come. Yeah, so a parent or a family member can go in and input symptoms of maybe their child or a family member. They can, upload photos and other information. You run the tests on the background, which or back end, which is more of a algorithm. I'm guessing you're processing tons of data and trying to figure out what's the match, right?
Yeah.
And then you're also sending them physical tests that they can do that go to a lab that you partner with. So there are a lot of different steps in this process, and it is, self-reported, and it sounds like there could be maybe potential for error, but talk about maybe the accuracy rates of these tests and what you're finding.
Yeah, so I think one thing that's important to explain to people who are not familiar with genetic tests is that genetic tests are really different from your standard like blood iron level tests or anything that you might be used to, where with like an iron level test, let's say there's a number that pops out at the end, which is your iron levels. And then based on that, a doctor can look at that number and say your levels are too high or too low. And based on that, we need to do some sort of intervention, like give you supplements or whatever else it is, or you need to change your diet. Genetic tests are really different from that because it's much earlier in the scientific evolution of these tests. When you get a result, when we get the raw data back, then a bioinformatician, usually two bioinformaticians, have to look at the raw genetic data of a patient and sift through hundreds of thousands or millions of mutations, or we call them variants, and decide which ones of these are pathogenic, likely pathogenic, of uncertain significance, or likely benign or benign. So it's much more, there's an interpretation step involved in this. So already in there, you've got a level of complexity that's different from standard medical tests. The way that we assess whether or not the whole system works is we look at what percentage of the people we test get back a confirmatory test result. So they've got a pathogenic or a likely pathogenic variant for a disease that really looks a lot like their phenotype. And we run lots of different disease programs. But for example, in our pediatric seizure program, well over 60% of the people we test actually have a genetic epilepsy. So it's a really, really high hit rate. And I think if you remind yourself of the fact that these are mostly concerned parents who landed on a website they've never heard of before, who typed in some symptomatic information on their kid, and then got a test kit in the mail, that's a really shockingly high number, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And especially for, we know how invested and how passionate and driven, obviously, these parents and family members and patients themselves are to really get to the root of their problems, right? As you mentioned earlier, they've been undiagnosed for 7 or 8 years. They've gone to a number of specialists. They've probably been on a number of drugs, and they're still looking for something that will actually help them in the long term. So that's great to hear. And tell us a little bit about what happens, when they do get that positive test result. Okay, we've identified this condition. Then what happens with the back end of probably genetic?
Yeah, so the answer is it really depends. And it depends on the disease that the patients get diagnosed with. In the best of cases, they get diagnosed with a condition for which a treatment is already approved, in which case the genetic counselors can educate them as to what the approved treatment options are and what types of specialists can help them get access to those treatments. That's the best case. And unfortunately, people in rare diseases know this. We only have treatments for about 5% of all rare diseases, and there is something like 10,000 rare diseases out there. So it's a really depressingly low number. Now, the thing that gets me excited is there's a huge research community out there that's conducting treatment development for a very large number of diseases, and the number is only going to go up over time. And because of innovations we have in gene therapies and antisense oligonucleotides and other modalities, hopefully really soon the 5% number is going to be a lot higher. So that's if people have a disease that is actually treatable today. If they the second sort of second best scenario are people who get diagnosed with a condition for which clinical trials are available, in which case the genetic counselors in our own system can match those patients to a clinical trial, and we provide them with information as to how they can participate in that clinical trial. And then there's unfortunately still a really large category of people who get diagnosed with those conditions where we cannot tell them that there is a treatment, and we also cannot tell them that there is a trial available. And that may sound depressing, and I think it is, but I think it's really important to put yourself in the shoes of a patient or a parent of a patient who spent 7 or 8 years only knowing that they're extremely sick and that they're probably getting worse and not knowing why, right? Like, those people incur tremendously large medical costs. They get treatments that they shouldn't be getting. Sometimes those treatments include unnecessary surgeries. And for them, even just knowing what the actual cause of all of their symptoms is actually a really, really large benefit. And also, once you know what's going on, you can stay up to date on research and development that's actually happening for your disease. So even if status today, there might not be a treatment for this, that the answer might be completely different just in a couple of years. People might have seen this, but just a few days ago, the first few kids got diagnosed with a gene therapy for a congenital hearing loss disorder, and that's a condition where just a few weeks ago, literally nobody had been treated for that. So I think the good news is there's a lot happening, but the bad news is we still got a really far way to go.
Yeah, interesting. We've seen too, when these patient families or patients themselves rally together, that sometimes they're able to, identify a researcher who might have done some work on this in the past, but is willing to pick it up again, or they may be able to, group together funding and start running their own studies. And so I think it's really, it is a first step in that direction, right? And after so much time without information, I think it probably is quite, reassuring to know that there's an answer somewhere.
Yeah, I think it's actually really important to really highlight those heroic patient advocacy groups that you just mentioned. I think this is a concept that's completely unfamiliar to most people outside of, certainly most people outside of healthcare, but even most people outside of rare diseases, where you get all of these parents. It's usually parents, sometimes it's patients, who go through the diagnostic odyssey. So they've done the 8 or whatever years of not knowing what's going on. Then they get this terrible message of, your kid has this disease, and that's it. There's nothing we can do for them. You can just go and make them comfortable. And a small number of those parents say, I'm not happy with that outcome. I'm going to go and I'm going to build a patient advocacy group. I do not have a scientific or medical background, but I don't care. I'm going to go and I'm going to raise money. I'm going to build up this 501c charity. And I'm going to try to figure out how the hell, gene therapies work and ASOs work. And I'm going to try to partner with pharma companies and do this stuff. And it's just remarkable how many, I mean, they're real heroes like that exist and do that work. We are just ourselves, we're partnered with over 45 different patient advocacy groups who all fit that profile. And many of the successful therapeutic programs we have today literally would not exist if it wasn't for the early grassroots work done by these patient advocacy groups. So I think you make a really important point there.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that. And I'll just make a short plug for the Year of the Zebra newsletter. And each week we send these out. If you go to osmosis.org/zebra, you can get on a newsletter that will actually highlight a number of these patient advocacy groups and point you in the direction of donation or support or recent research. So for healthcare students or, current providers or parents or patients, they can get a lot of information there, which is great. Speaking of kind of advancing this field of knowledge and trying to improve, not just education, but obviously therapy and treatment and outcomes for patients, Talk to us a little bit about how probably genetic is really improving the rare disease space and where you kind of hope this goes in the next few years.
Sure. I love that question. I think the got a short term and a long term answer on this. And I think the short term answer is pretty obvious, which is, the vast majority of these people go undiagnosed. Being undiagnosed is a really horrible outcome because not only are you getting treated with stuff you shouldn't be treated with, and you don't know what's going on, but more importantly, even if there are treatments or there are clinical trials, if you're undiagnosed, you're never going to know about them. And so the short-term impact that we're having and that we're already having today is just to get more people diagnosed and to get them from all these obscure places where in the healthcare system where they're not getting help and get them help. That's the most immediate one. The long-term vision, I think, is even more important, which is, I mentioned that 5% of the rare diseases that have treatments today, and the 95% that don't have treatments today. And our hope is that by doing the work we're doing today and like building a really great mechanism to just find these people really, really quickly and get them diagnosed, we can build a platform that in the future you can do a huge chunk of clinical trial recruitment, treatment matching, real-world evidence tracking, and even perhaps most importantly, early stage R&D on. Because the challenge here is if we don't have really large data infrastructures where we have DNA symptoms and contact information of these patients, we just can't crack the nut on a whole lot of these diseases. And a lot of that was really, motivation that came out of the 100,000 Genomes Project, because I think what they're doing for, initially 100,000 people and now a few million people, I think if you spun that up to a global level and built a really large platform, you could really usher in a new age of therapeutics we probably just can't get to right now.
That's a very exciting future and hopefully something that accelerates in the coming weeks and months. And interestingly, I think with COVID, we've heard from a number of researchers that that kind of shifted the way that research is done on a global scale and how information is shared. And hopefully some of the infrastructure that was built during that time could be leveraged for other things such as rare disease research and therapeutic advancements. So we'll certainly be following that. You mentioned one story of Julia, the parent that you met earlier, but are there other kind of lasting imprints of patients that have been impacted by probably genetic or maybe stories that you can share about its impact?
Yeah, my fiance always tells me that I'm the worst party guest because I've only got really depressing stories. But I'll tell them regardless. I mean, I'll just pick a few. I mean, I mentioned the epilepsy program before that we run. Via that program, you would think that we'd only diagnose patients who don't have access at all to, specialized healthcare providers who just know what a genetic epilepsy looks like. Many of the patients we diagnose are actually being seen by chairs of pediatric epilepsy at, leading universities in the United States. We've got patients who are being seen by board certified neurologists. We've got patients who are being seen by members of the American Society for Human Genetics. So unfortunately, there's many patients out there who are actually seeing the right specialists and still don't get diagnosed. I guess the way to put a good spin on that is we found them, and now they got diagnosed. So that's, I think, that's a plus. I'll give you two really depressing stories just to kind of round this off. We have one patient that we diagnosed 2 weeks after they had a leg amputated because of their genetic disease that had gone undiagnosed up until that point, and that really shouldn't happen, right? Like that, we just have to be faster with that, and we have to scale it up a lot so that we can find these people a lot earlier. And mind you, that person had an amputation without knowing why they're having an amputation, and that's just completely crazy. Another program that we work on right now is a condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, where patients have many bone fractures and break their bones really at a large frequencies, so a lot of breaks and a lot of fractures, and often really early in life. And one of the really depressing things about that is the most common misdiagnosis for children with that condition is child abuse. So not only are their parents going through this experience of my kids breaking their bones all the time, I don't know what's going on and nobody's helping me, all of a sudden they have to fight the system to not lose their kids because people are suspecting that they're hurting their own children. And so that's the depressing side of it. But the hopeful side of it is, if you find those patients really quickly, you can get them diagnosed and hopefully, avoid worse outcomes like that.
What a stressful situation. And I mean, these are very sobering stories, but obviously we hear the other side too. And it sounds like as you continue your work, we'll hear many more positive stories, hopefully, of people finding their diagnosis sooner and getting the right treatment sooner. But I know we're running short on time, so I just have two quick questions for you. Osmosis is an education company. We love to fill in gaps for knowledge. What areas would you like to see Osmosis create more educational content around?
I think one that you could do, and I don't know if you've done that, so apologies if you have, is I think there needs to be a redefinition of what rare means. Because yes, every single one of these 10,000 disorders is rare, but collectively, that's something like 400 million patients on the planet. And so, given that a whole lot of medical students follow your content and read everything you put out, I think medical students should really switch their mindset. And instead of thinking, this is the odd one out, that's the zebra, they should consider that it's extremely likely that they'll encounter many really unique cases in their journey as physicians. And while this might be, so that's part one, kind of reframing that and like changing their mindset, like the rare thing is probably the most likely thing you'll encounter. That's part one. And then part two is, they'll never ch stand a chance to be able to diagnose those 10,000 conditions on their own because they don't have enough time in medical school with all the following workshops and everything to learn the diagnosis of those conditions. But if you can become really smart about using tools like the stuff that we're putting out and like the stuff that other artificial intelligence companies are putting out, then you can get assistance from technology to solve that diagnostic challenge that you yourself simply can't possibly master because it's too much information. So those two. Reframing and
And
technology.
technology. And I'm guessing that, students or healthcare providers can access probably genetic, and could they potentially go in and input information and on a patient's behalf and get that information? Is that how some are using it today?
Actually, yeah, we didn't intend it like that originally, but we can already see that tons of physicians are using it that way. And we're working on building more information flows so that the physicians can stay up to date with the process that their patients are going through as well. But they already are.
That's great. Well, hopefully we see more
Yeah.
of that. And I know I'm leaving you 1 minute here, but maybe just for those listening, any advice you have to future clinicians or existing clinicians as they encounter some of the challenges in healthcare today?
I mean, from where I'm sitting, I would say like familiarize yourself with everything that's going on in clinical development for these conditions, because I think the conventional wisdom that if there is no treatment today, it doesn't make sense to try to help a patient get diagnosed is not only wrong, I think it's harmful. So stay up to date with what's going on in research, even as you venture out and leave academia, because there's a lot happening, and the stuff you learn today is not going to be true anymore in 5 years from now.
That's great advice. So, Dr. Lang, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Hilary. This is fun.
I'm Hilary Acer. Thanks for checking out today's show. Remember to do your part to raise the line and strengthen the healthcare system. We're all in this together.
If you like this podcast, please share it on your social channels. You can also subscribe to the series and check out all of our episodes at osmosis.org/raisethelinepodcast.